We received a letter recently from a family in Detroit. There are three children in the family, and the little boy, Ralphie, is aged five. And sometimes he's a little bad, and whenever the mother reprimands him, he always says to her, "Mother, will you give me another chance?" "Surely," said the mother. And this particular Saturday, the mother went to confession, and she took little Ralph with her. And when she came out of the confessional box and knelt down in the pew alongside of Ralph to say her penance, Ralph said, "Did God give you another chance?" Tonight, we're going to take you on a tour to Paris. Most Americans see a great deal in Paris, and then there are some, you know, that can see no value at all in Europe. I really and truly heard of an American, when he came to Switzerland, told a friend of mine in Switzerland, "You know, I haven't seen anything in Europe that's worthwhile. All the buildings are old, and even the art is ancient. No modern art of any kind." And this friend of mine in Switzerland said, "Well, what do you think about Switzerland? Isn't it beautiful?" And he said, "Well, take away the scenery and what have you got left?" Well, tonight we take you to the city of Paris. Paris originally was on an island. And we'll show you a picture of that little island as it looks today. It's called the Ile de Cité. It looks like a ship that was sunk into the Seine. And that little island was called Lutetia, the White City. And it was there that Paris took its origin. It is said that because the island looked like a boat, par, that Paris itself derived its name. And it was only later on that Paris began to swell out to either banks of the Seine. Now, on this particular island, the Druids built an altar. They dedicated it to their gods, and they also dedicated an altar to the Virgin who would bring forth a son. Then later on, when Julius Caesar came and conquered Gaul, remember Julius Caesar? All Gaul is divided into three parts. He afterwards built there on that same island an altar to Jupiter. And then when Christianity began to come into Gaul, or what is now France, the first apostle who came there by the name of Denis built a church in honor of Saint Stephen and built it on the island and on the spot where once the Druids had an altar, where once the Romans had an altar to Jupiter. And then this old church, St. Stephen, continued to stand in that island until the year 538, when another church was built alongside of it. But it was not dedicated to St. Stephen. The Eastern world was then showing great devotion to the one that they called Theotokos, Mother of God. And so the Western world decided to build a church in honor of Our Lady, Notre Dame. And in 538, alongside of this old church of St. Stephen, was constructed the Church of Notre Dame. In 1128, these 600 years later, he was born in the Loire section of France, a child by the name of Maurice de Sully. Came up to Paris to study. He was a peasant boy. And he studied at that church of Notre Dame because the original University of Paris was around the portals of Notre Dame. That's where the students used to gather. It was there the philosophers taught. Someday on television, we may tell you about a very famous teacher who taught there and looked out at someone holding the hand of a little 2 or 3 year old girl. One of the most interesting stories of the Middle Ages. And he was also often in the library. In those days, a book cost just as much as a house did. And the greatest library in France was at the Cathedral of Notre Dame. Maurice de Sully became a great preacher. So very famous that he was known all over Europe. And some of his sermons today exist in the Bodleian Library at Oxford, England. And finally, he was named the Bishop of Paris. And he succeeded. And everyone who knows philosophy in the audience will recall immediately the name of the great philosopher whom he succeeded, Peter Lombard. And after his consecration, he came back to Paris. Here was this old church. It was not large enough. Paris was a big city. 50,000 people in Paris in those days. And these two churches were not large enough for the throngs. He decided to build a church that would be big enough for everyone in the city. And so when he came back after his consecration, he took his crozier and he went out around that aisle, that Ile de Cité, and he made marks all around the island. And when he had finished those marks, he said, that will be the site of the new Cathedral of Notre Dame. He reigned for 36 years, and he practically saw it completed. It took only 70 years to build. And this cathedral, well, let us show you first of all some pictures. Here is the Cathedral of Notre Dame alongside of the Seine today, on the site of the old Druid altar. This is the cathedral illuminated at night. The front door of the cathedral. And the dimensions? The cathedral was 434 feet long. It was 124 feet wide. The towers of the cathedral were 223 feet high. Up until 1931, there was not a single bridge in New York City that was as high as the Tower of Notre Dame built 700 years ago. Inside of the cathedral, 7,700,000 cubic feet. This is the interior of the cathedral. Side view of the arches and the rose window. We will speak of that in a moment. In those days, there was a kind of a fever of building. Within a radius of 150 miles of Paris, and incidentally, all the distances from Paris, even to this day, are measured not by the distance from the Arc de Triomphe or from the Opera. All distances in Paris are measured from Notre Dame, and to Notre Dame. I say there was a great fever of building. There were 50 cathedrals, many of them almost about the size of Notre Dame, like Reims, Chartres, Lyon, that were built in France. 500 churches in addition to the 50 cathedrals. And what was it that inspired the people in those days to throw these great piles of stone into the air? Faith, certainly. As Ralph Adams Cram said, we could not build cathedrals like that today simply because we do not have the faith. But in the natural order, there was something else. Men were always fond of building towers. Hence, the Tower of Babel was a dedication to a humanism that was anti-God. The Greeks used to build their towers and their monuments to honor their philosophers and their dramatists. The Greeks, in order to honor their generals. The American builds towers to honor American enterprise. But these towers and these great piles of stone were erected for only one purpose, namely to glorify God. And the people who built them They had a dual nature. First of all, they were deeply sensitive, passionate, almost primitive. And on the other hand, they were keenly intellectual. Reason reached a higher peak in those days than it did at any other time in the history of the world, with the exception of the 5th century before Christ. And when you get a combination of this deep, passionate nature allied to a flashing intelligence, you create a tension which can really beget cathedrals and other works of art. As one architect of the 20th century said, in those days, they never made a mistake in their works of art. And then in addition to this inspiration, there was the fact that many of them were coming back from the Crusades. They had seen the great architecture of the Byzantine periods. They'd also derived considerable inspiration from Islam. But at any rate, this became one of the great showplaces of the world, where 12,500 people could worship at one time. And many interesting things and events took place in there. First of all, here's the beautiful rose window, and we'll tell you a story about the rose window. This rose window has at the center a picture of image of Notre Dame. Now, there was also, in addition to the glazier who made this window, a sculptor who made the gargoyles. The gargoyles are those horrid little demons that peer out from behind pillars and so forth to remind you that even in church there are temptations. And the gargoyle maker looked very much like his gargoyles. He was a very ugly sort of individual. And of course, he fell in love with the beautiful wife of the maker of the Madonna window. Well, gossip got around. And finally, the word came to the glazier. And he took it out on his wife, not on the gargoyle maker. And when finally the gargoyle maker heard about it, he took a hammer and went to one of the fine sections of the Madonna window and threw a hammer through it. And then he left the eel. He fled Paris. And then he came back, and the glazier maker was waiting for him, and he threw him into the Seine. And according to the legend, Notre Dame appeared over him in the Seine as he was about to go down, and with that, the glazier jumped into the Seine, saved the ugly gargoyle maker, and from that time on, they lived very happily. And it was said that the repaired window was far more beautiful than the original. That was just one tiny little incident in the building of the cathedral. And in those days, there were good men, there were bad men. One of the differences between those days and ours is that then the bad men knew they were bad men. You know, it's one thing to get off the road, and it's another thing to throw away the map. Those people never threw away the map. It's not often that governments ever get leadership that is vastly superior in moral quality to the masses of the people. Generally, they reflect the mediocrity of the people themselves. But in those days, contemporaneous with the building of this cathedral, the leader of the people, the king, was above the level of society. King St. Louis IX. When he was a little boy, his mother, Queen Blanche, used to take him in on Holy Thursday into the cathedral when the bishop washed the feet of the poor, and she made Louis wash the feet of the beggars in order that he would learn to love the poor. And then when he became king, he used to get up every midnight and go into the cathedral to pray. 4 o'clock, he was there again for matins, for early mass. And every single night, he used to have 200 beggars at his table. He never invited those who could invite him back. One day a woman mocked him and said he was not fit to be a king. He said, "Lady, you are so right. I only wish that God would send someone in my place." But alongside of King St. Louis, there was also, a little later on, François Villon. Alongside of the doors of Notre Dame, he wrote his verses. He pilfered. He made love. He even murdered. The last poet of the Middle Ages, first poet of modern times. But he knew he was bad. And so he wrote out a poem to his mother, for his mother. And he asked his mother every day to go and kneel before the statue of Notre Dame and to pray for him that eventually he would come back again to God. And those two represent some of the extremes of the Middle Ages. And in that great cathedral too, Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette sponsored a great wedding. And 100 brides came in from one door of the cathedral, and 100 grooms came in from the other. And King, I was about to say St. Louis, he was not a saint, Louis XVI. And Louis XVI stamped the marriage contract of each with his seal on the hilt of his sword. Then, November the 10th, 1793, France was beginning to lose its faith, and then came the revolution. And the revolutionists went to the Cathedral of Notre Dame, threw ropes and lassos about the statues of 28 kings on the outside, pulled them down from their niches, decapitated the stone kings, and then threw the torsos into the Seine. And then they changed the name of the Cathedral of Notre Dame to the Cathedral of Reason. And they brought in scenery from the opera. And they put the scenery behind the main altar of Notre Dame. It was the scenery of a vast mountain. And on top of that mountain was a statue dedicated to philosophy. And then with music, a ballet chorus comes in from what was originally the sacristy. When they finally danced about the sanctuary, Mademoiselle Aubry of the opera, who was called a masterpiece of nature, clothed in white with a cincture of blue, comes to the altar of Notre Dame for its final desecration. And everyone in the cathedral shouts out all praise to the goddess of reason. She has in her sword, in her hand, a kind of sword which symbolized the sword of truth or philosophy. Notre Dame became desecrated. And one little man by the name of Lenotre took down the beautiful image of Notre Dame that was dated from the middle of the 13th century and hid the statue for better days when it was finally replaced. And there too, in that same cathedral, Napoleon was crowned. The 13th premier. Premier means cold, and it was cold on that December morning of 1804, 28 carriages, 6,000 foot soldiers, and 180 horses made up the cortege. And Pius VII came up from Rome to crown Napoleon. And the night before, he and Napoleon met. Now, the coronation ceremony is a very, very old one. Oil is used. There's great solemnity and sacredness about it. And the formula always used is coronet vos Deus, God crowned you. Napoleon said, "We will not use that formula. We will use the formula accipe coronam, receive the crown." Pius VII said, "No, all authority comes from God. As our blessed Lord said to Pilate, you would not have this power unless it were given to you from above. And even your authority, Napoleon, comes from God. Napoleon said it will be occupe corona. Pius VII refused. In the morning of the coronation, Pius VII was kept waiting there for about 2 hours, and finally Napoleon comes in. There comes the morning moment of crowning, and as Pius VII is about to put the crown upon the head of Napoleon with the words, Coronet vos Deus, Napoleon snatches the crown from his own head, from his own hands, and puts it on his own head. Maybe you might be interested if the camera can come close enough. Can you come to my hand here? This is the ring that belonged to Pius VII, who crowned Napoleon in the Cathedral of Notre Dame on December the 2nd, 1804. It is not a precious ring as regards intrinsic worth, but it is a precious ring as regards its historical connotation. It was in that cathedral, too, that the great Lacordaire preached. And one understands how great preachers are made when you see how Lacordaire lived. Lacordaire used to have a little niche cut in the corner of his cell where he could look out on the tabernacle below, and from which he would derive the inspiration from his sermons. I've seen at the base of the Carme in Paris, it's still there, the cross on which Lacordaire used to rope himself, the crown of thorns that he used to put on his head on Good Friday morning in order to prepare himself by some kind of mortification for preaching the sermon of Good Friday afternoon in the Cathedral of Notre Dame. And so the events go on in this great palace of stone. It's a principle of life, what goes into a cathedral. There are two principles of life. One is the pyramid. Pyramid is constructed stone upon stone, one imposing itself upon the other, with a kind of an absolute equality in which there is no differentiation by function. And finally, at the peak of the pyramid is the keystone arch that rests upon them all and almost thrust its weight upon them all. That keystone of the pyramid can be either a Khrushchev or a Bulganin. It makes no difference which. And then at the very base of the pyramid itself is death, a tomb, whether it be a Lenin or a Stalin. But there's no belief in any other kind of life than the pyramid principle. And in the cathedral, the stones are related one to another as regards their function. And the great arch has its foot on the earth and has its head in the heavens. And the cement is charity that holds the stone symbolic of persons together. And above all else in the cathedral, there is a freedom with fellowship, because the cathedral makes room for air and makes room for light, makes room for truth and love. On Palm Sunday, when our blessed Lord came into Jerusalem, there were those who bade the apostles to speak to the Savior. There was too much acclaim, too many hosannas in his honor, and our blessed Lord said, if these are silent, even the stones would cry out. And the stones did cry out. They burst into cathedrals like Notre Dame. And it was dedicated, yes, dedicated to a woman. But do not think that because it was dedicated to a woman that she's adored. She is not adored. She's not a goddess. She is human. Why then is there so much veneration and respect paid in a cathedral? Why is it dedicated to her? Because she is the rampart. She is the outpost. She is the human door by which divinity came into this earth. And that's why they regard her as someone who is to be revered. So long as the ramparts are safe, then the city will be safe. So long as the mother is secure, then the son will be proclaimed as divine. That's the reason of veneration for her. And so in that stone, and all of us summoned to her to make us warriors, warriors of faith, that she may make the assault upon omnipotence.
Bye now, and God love you.